what a life. Baby, I'm in love.
This is WHFR Dearborn, and now it's time for our public affairs show, the new WHFR Journal, local news and alternative views. Welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal, our public affairs show here at WHFR.FM, the station making waves. We are local news for Dearborn and the surrounding area, and alternative views, critical thinking, analysis. We'd like to believe that we can add to things. Yours truly, Jay Koronik. I'm here, and what do I bring to it? Well, college professor for 40 years here at Henry Ford Community College, teaching media. Yeah, radio, TV stuff. So I know which end of the microphone to talk into, that's for sure. But with me today to help balance things out are our two WHFR news staff persons. First, Dennis Reimars, who is our WHFR news director. How you doing, Dennis? Okay, that wasn't your mic, so keep saying hello.
Hello, hello, hello.
That is your mic. Okay.
And I just learned the right end of the microphone to speak into.
No, I had it turned down. And Amy Powers here is in the studio too, our WHFR news reporter. Yeah, she's an official reporter, and a lot of our WHFR journal stories wouldn't be possible, and everybody jumps in and helps as they can. But Amy, what microphone are you talking on?
I'm talking on this microphone.
Okay, it must be the one that's already turned on then.
Hers works.
Yeah.
Well, I've had a little more experience than you, maybe.
No, it's just luck. It's luck of the draw here. What happens, folks,
luck of the draw.
At a non-commercial radio station is that we have over 60-person volunteer staff, and they've been trained and so on, but we have a 24/7 operation. It's true that classical music from Public Radio International is overnight from 2 to 10, but a lot of people in and out of the studio, a lot of guests, a lot of band members, and they play musical microphones in the station here. That's the mics are all on separate desk stands, and they get switched from left to right sometimes. Now, I guess we tried numbering them or color coding them, and then they switched the chords. So, I mean, whatever works, you know, here. So that's the explanation of that one. But what's happening in the news? That's why you tuned in. That's why you're connected to our podcast, which is available after 2 p.m. every Friday. If you missed the show until the next Friday, there it is on the website. And we do archive back a month or two. Or three or four on the WHFR.FM website, too, for the journal. Just click on the journal button and pick the appropriate date, and you can listen all over again or, you know, or for the first time if needed. We believe here, this is Dennis, Amy, and I, that the top story should be that the Dearborn Public School Support Staff Union has rejected the contract that was offered to them. Here's the basic story as reported in the Dearborn Press and Guide from this Wednesday, 2 days ago, December 9th. Katie Hetrick is the reporter in this case. Dearborn Public Schools support staff rejected the district's contract offer on Sunday. So layoffs will begin next week, right before Christmas. There's the holiday spirit, folks. The Dearborn Federation of School Employees rejected the proposed contract 410 to 315. That wasn't a really close vote. That was about, 60-40 would be my guess. So apparently about 725 people voted. Probably the union has a few more. Not everyone always votes, even if it's a big question like this. But maybe everybody did vote. In any event, it was about 60-40 rejected. That's according to President Tim Kearney. And he said, quote, "The reduction in pay is the biggest issue." The details here. The proposal asked employees to take a 6.3% pay cut this year and a similar cut next year. So, I mean, they're already projecting, and maybe we'll share with you Jack Lessenberry's story from the Metro Times this week. Next year will be worse for the state of Michigan. And remember, folks, it's the state of Michigan that's funding our schools. They're collecting our taxes, but they're giving back whatever they can or whatever they choose to. And so this contract, over 2 years, if it had been approved, would have been a 12.6% pay cut. However, no one would have been laid off.
Yeah, that's the key.
Yeah, no one would have been laid off. And so that was the criteria. But the majority voted self-interest because the majority are probably not the ones being laid off. The pay cuts and other concessions would have pulled from the chopping block most of the jobs, maybe not all, I guess, represented by the union. DFSE covers secretaries, paraprofessionals. Are those professionals who know how to use parachutes? Or,
I think that's like teacher's aides.
Okay. I don't think your mic is really on, Dennis.
Well.
Go ahead.
Is that better? Oh, I see. Yeah, that's perfect.
It was that other one was picking up. So, you're on top of it now.
I know,
so, right,
on the show.
A paraprofessional is somebody who has some training and maybe class work or whatever to be a professional, like a professional teacher or a professional counselor or a professional whatever, but they're not quite there yet, but they can be assistants. So they can be really significant help. They're not just volunteers from the community, although some volunteers maybe know a lot of stuff, but they are very specifically partially trained to help the professionals. And so paraprofessionals are also represented by the DFSE, Dearborn Federation of Support Employees?
School employees.
School employees, yes, but support staff primarily, including also food service workers, bus drivers. Who's going to drive the buses if you don't have... Okay, custodians and other non-instructional positions. The union covers about... Oh, here's the total number. 1,151. Isn't that interesting? 1,151 employees and only 725 voted in the election, in the contract.
Right.
If the other people would have voted, let's say, in favor, it would have changed everything all around. Such an important contract... How can so many not vote?
Well, it's almost like the standard elections where so few people turn out to vote. Was it 29% here in Dearborn over the last election?
But a lot of people feel that
probably higher.
But federal government, even state or local government, it doesn't have immediate effect upon them. This is a contract that's so close.
It concerns everyone.
Their families.
I don't know why they wouldn't be voting on it.
Some of the people, and this I talked to our president here, Dr. Gail Mee, yesterday in person about this, and this is, she basically stated the same thing is true here, and it's going to be a disaster. Some of these people work at Henry Ford Community College. So it's not just Dearborn Public Schools. It turns out the DFSE, they have unionized as one union, not two locals, but as one union, all the support staff in both operations, the so-called K-12 Dearborn Public Schools and Henry Ford Community College, which is run by the Board of Ed. They have different names. They call themselves the Board of Trustees, but they're the same people that you elect for your Board of Ed members. They are the Board of Trustee members. And even though they're separate budgets for Henry Ford Community College and Dearborn Public Schools, it's still the same legal entity. And so that's how DFSE can organize. Now, the teacher unions are separate. The administrator unions are separate in the district between K-12 and Henry Ford Community College, but not the DFSE. So what does that mean here? Specifically, according to Dr. Mee, what it means is we, first of all, depending on how many people are laid off ultimately, will have bumping by seniority. So some of the people that might be here at Henry Ford Community College but only have a couple years of service, they're going to be the first to go because the people that are laid off are the people that are lower in seniority, and whether or not that's totally fair, that's the way it is contractually almost everywhere. And so I think they say the total here is about 120 employees. So that's about 10%,
right.
120 out of 1,150 employees in this union. And so we will lose some of our people, but we will get other people of higher seniority for many of our positions. Of course, 10% fewer people, that means 10% fewer positions somewhere. They're not hiring to fill these. So there's 120 jobs that are not going to be filled, and my guess is a couple dozen of those 120, maybe, I hope it's not that many, maybe just a dozen, here at Henry Ford Community College. And, okay, it's a Henry Ford Community College radio station, but the opinions we express here on the air and the opinion I'm going to express next myself on the air are not necessarily those of Henry Ford Community College. Not the opinion of our president or anyone else here, but I have worked here for a long time. It's a great institution. We have a major social need to be good for everybody that needs our community college education right now. We are the cheapest higher education institution in the Detroit metro area, or almost, maybe tied with Wayne County. But we have many more programs. We have 18,000 students. We're busting at the seams. Enrollment, because people need us. They've got to retrain. They've got to find new jobs. This is the easiest and fastest way to get people back to work or to get people into a secure job that maybe they don't have right now, is to fund Henry Ford Community College and to staff it fully. And even though there's nothing, according to Dr. Mee, that really can be done because the union is the union and their contract is with the board, and the board controls both institutions, and so we don't have a leg to stand on except, I think, my personal, it's patently wrong to make our operation that's so important, as if K-12 isn't important for all the kids in the district, an ever-growing community of kids in Dearborn, but they're going to have fewer support services, and we know fewer teachers too, fewer administrators because of these cuts. So it's a terrible thing, especially for Henry Ford Community College to be part of this. And I'd like to ask, this is just ethical questions, and Amy and Dennis, they're just going to speak from their own minds and hearts here. If you were in the support union here, if you were a member of the DFSE support union, and this came up for a vote, let's say, first of all, if you were not in the bottom 10% of seniority, how would you vote, Amy, on this?
You know, I'm sure it seems easy to say from this position, not being in the upper seniority of this group or the lower seniority or the, you know, the newly hired, but it just seems unconscionable that these people in this state at this time wouldn't be looking out for each other and wouldn't be voting to save all the jobs, looking down the line at, say, a 12.5% pay cut over 2 years. It's not that much. It's time to kind of focus on a larger community aspect and make some cuts in your own life. 10% is not that challenging. It's a lot more challenging when you lose a job.
Depends on what you're trying to afford. If you got kids going to college and the tuition's going up, not just at Henry Ford Community College, well, our tuition hasn't gone up yet, but the four-year schools, I mean, major burden. So it depends on your family commitments and so on.
It's a larger burden when you don't have a job.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Or if you're just barely, your job, the job you have is just barely able to pay the mortgage, mm-hmm. too, which might have been one of those APR things that have jumped up. And that's, you know, a lot of people think, oh, people couldn't pay the mortgage. Why didn't they know that when they got it? Again, it was an adjustable rate mortgage, folks. Those were the ones that people didn't know how bad it was going to get when the rates went up, skyrocketed up, and then the banks, they don't care. They're just trying to collect on the dollars. Of course, that doesn't make any sense to me.
Adjustable rates always go up.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
That's a given.
The number one rule in finance these days, the number one thing my parents taught me, too, when I was young, never, never, ever, when you buy a house, get anything other than a fixed rate mortgage.
That's right.
Never, ever, ever.
It was gospel in our house, too.
They said, well, the adjustable rate is low now, and my job's only going to get better, and how high could that adjustable rate mortgage go? As high as they want it to go, folks.
Sure.
Oh, my God. Okay, Dennis, if you were either part of the 90% of who wouldn't be laid off or not, how would you vote? Tough call, I know, but ethically, is it united we stand, divided we fall, or how do you see it?
I have to agree with Amy. Mm-hmm. Very well said. I think that this is we have to look at community now, and we have to look at this is a short term thing. I mean, 2 years sounds like a long time, but I think we all feel, or at least we see signs of everything kind of rebounding, and it may take a little bit longer here in our area. But no, I absolutely agree with you, Amy. 100%.
And I think it's tough for particularly people working at Henry Ford because enrollment's gone up, 27% this year?
Yeah.
It's tough to lose a job when you're seeing that enrollment has increased so dramatically. But that's, you know, the union representation.
Yeah. I mean, auto workers, I think, pretty much they voted for pay reductions for the sake of keeping all their members employed. I think the Ford workers... I can't remember the stat. I shouldn't have brought it up. Ford Motor Company workers didn't want the same contract of GM because they said, we're doing better than other car companies. We didn't even need a bailout,
right.
You know. I mean, and Ford stock, thank you very much, has quadrupled since last year at this time. And I bought some of those $2 shares. So now I got $100.
So I got $8.
I was going to say we may not see him next week then.
No, I just thought I was doing something, you know, as a token
local.
For America.
No, I get it.
Oh, my God, Ford shares have gone up. If I only had like $10 million to invest last year at this time, oh, my God, $40 million. But, hey, the folks, stock market is not the answer here. It's a, you know, it's as bad as going to the casino.
Unless you got a lot of money last year.
Yeah, and I don't even bet at the casinos, folks. This is yours truly's opinion. Unless you've got money to spare, money to burn, money you don't really need anyway.
Sure.
Does anybody have money they don't
like
really need?
Well, the stock market as well.
Yeah.
It's money to burn.
Yes, I think so. I mean, it could be a risky element of a savings plan or investment. I mean, investment plans... But there's tremendous risk, so you got to know what you're doing. Yours truly, and I have retired now, I took risks through mutual funds, which for many years would balance the risk.
Sure.
You know, because professionals, other than myself, were picking the funds. Now, before the big crash of the whole market, that wasn't a bad thing to do. But I never took individual stock risks in all my 40 years of having a real salary, just because I thought it was too risky. And thank goodness I was able to retire last year because... I was thinking of retiring 3.5, 4 years ago, and I thought I could do it. And then the financial issue came up. But I switched all my investments away from the mutual funds into fixed. In other words, just a set rate, guaranteed no matter what. And I didn't lose a penny. All these people that were still in either mutual funds or individual stocks, of course, the whole market dropped, not just the banks.
That's exactly
right. Thanks for
bringing that up again. Well, no, so many people are like, well, only blue chip stocks, and you know, they've weathered the storm. Everything.
All I'm saying is, even now, you know, make investments, but make sure they're very secure and very safe, and look for fixed rate mortgages and guaranteed interest. I'm railing against several local banks right now. Every time I talk to them, I say, don't you dare drop the interest another 0.1%, or I'm taking my money out. There's some online banks. I mean, big names. American Express, Capital One. They're online only, which means your money is not, you know, right next door or across the street, as if it ever was.
Right,
you
right.
know, local banks really don't have it across the street. But you can get almost double the interest through these online savings banks. And I keep threatening my local credit union with that. And they just keep dropping the interest. And I'm thinking, why? Because, in fact, this credit union was voted, and I won't mention the name because they are a commercial entity and not a nonprofit in this case. They were voted the best managed credit union in Michigan.
Well, also in defense of credit unions, I mean,
and they didn't need a bailout at all.
Exactly, yeah. And they were the ones that sort of kept their
good management principles, right?
Exactly, mm-hmm. Good management principles. They, you know, kept banking boring and did the solid loans for homes and. You know, stayed secure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, and I want to support them. Those kinds of local credit unions and local banks that want to give money and loan money to, you know, people of modest incomes who at least they have a job. You know, there's some security there, and you really don't want to support the big banks that took these bailouts because they've already shown they had bad or extremely risky management practices. You hate, as most of the people in the country, you hate to see an operation that is badly managed get a bailout from our government, and it doesn't seem to help the people that had their money there at all. I mean, as I pointed out to customer service somewhere last week of a bank, you got the bailout money. The government is still loaning you money at 0% interest, and you're still cutting the interest to me? You're still cutting the interest? Well, it's difficult time. You got the, come on, there's no excuse for that. Just like the credit card companies, because they passed a credit card consumer protection bill nationally that's going to take effect later next year. They're all raising their interest rates, raising their late fees now. Because when the bill kicks in, they won't be able to do that. And some of them are already at 30% interest rates.
You know, people can opt out of those. They you have to actually read.
Give them up.
When you get that little notice in the mail that you can opt out of that and close them down, start paying cash.
Right. And there are ways of doing that. Of course, even my the local credit union, every time I go in there for a cash transaction or whatever, they say, and if you'd like to speak to our investment advisor right now on ways to handle your retirement money, I say, I don't think you should be doing that. You shouldn't be doing it. You're a bank. You do mortgages. You do savings accounts. You don't have an investment person. Besides, what does the investment person at the credit union really know? Were they formerly employed by Goldman Sachs, I mean, Bear Stearns, you know, Lehman Brothers, you know, what do they really know? This one, I mean, they could be very smart, but they're one person sitting there in the bank. What sort of resources do they have? I have as many resources probably as they do if you go online to some of these, you know, stock trading account company, a lot of information, whether it's Schwab or E-Trade or Ameritrade, and they're the good one because they got a good spokesperson from Law and Order, you know. And obviously, there must be the better company. No, not at all. But I'm just saying is that you can do the research yourself if you want to get risky. But I don't think these local institutions should get risky with your money. And why did they? And even before the crisis, most of the commercial banks were paying like 0.5% interest. How did they get off doing that? They were rolling in dough before the crisis hit, before all the mortgages went belly up.
Well, that's how they were rolling in the dough.
Yeah, right, yeah. Exactly. For the reason. Not giving anything back to the community. Right.
Well, you can't, I don't think you can necessarily fault a bank for having, or a credit union for having an investment person there. I mean, it's obviously they want to.
It's a service.
They're trying to do one-stop shopping and offer you full service, sure.
But they're going to get a commission from it, of
absolutely.
Course. Absolutely. It's not like they're. They want to sell you on something.
But it's your choice, you know.
Well, maybe not so much, because if you don't know what you want to choose, they're going to choose for you.
No, I mean, it's your choice to go through their investment person.
Exactly. Okay. Well, we got to move along, and it's a difficult call. I didn't state my opinion, but I would have voted for my colleagues. I would never vote for self-interest if my union members, if 10% of them are going to lose their jobs. I just never do that. And I cutting back, even though Amy says you can cut back 10 or 12%, it depends on your situation. That is really tough. That is very tough to do, I think, in my situation. But nonetheless, I would go for the union, the group. Again, divided you stand. Divided you do not stand, you fall. And so there you go. Okay, we'll move on to our next big story, which is it's getting kind of technical. We talked about it before. We'll try to get out of it quick and go to a Jim Hightower piece here, editorial opinion. CSO legal battle heating up. In the Dearborn Press and Guide from Wednesday, this is how they begin talking about it. Sean Delaney writes this. While the temperature is dropping outside, the city's legal battle over its federally mandated, and this is the title of it, the Combined Sewer Overflow, CSO, project. It continues to heat up. A settlement hearing with Barton Malow, that's Barton-Malow, one of several contractors involved in pending litigation involving the CSO project, has been scheduled for January 11th. So we'll come back to this after the 11th, following by a mediation hearing with another contractor, Wallbridge, later the same week. So all these people, if I can sum up real quickly, all these different contractors were hired, they got low bids, to dig a bunch of holes in the ground, sometimes 150 or more feet deep, to receive the sewage when the current sewer system overflows from like spring rains or, I don't know, massive, you know, hurricane hits us or something. Who knows what's going to happen? But when the water starts flowing over, it's going to contaminate a lot of things. And the Environmental Protection Agency years ago, I think it was 12 or 15 years ago, even our legislators, they voted that each city has to do these projects so that the drinking water is not contaminated. And we all want clean water, I think. Well, but Dearborn, in its lack of wisdom, many, many years ago, about 10 years ago, made a decision to go with unproven technology. Consultants recommended it. Unproven technology of all these special shafts, concrete reinforced shafts to go in the ground. Several of them, and again, I'm just ad-libbing here, but I know several of them have failed because of sulfur gas, of water leaks, the seepy soil. Is that a technical term? I know one construction worker died. One of these tunnels was going to be 30 feet in diameter. You could drive a house through some of these tunnels. And there were going to be 13 or 15 of these things. And you might say, well, that's what they had to do. They had to do it. No other community around here did it that way. And they're already done. They got their sewer overflow projects done already. And we're up at, well, it was projected at $320 million, but now with the lawsuits and so on, I think it's going to be over $400, maybe $500 million if it ever gets finished. And, of course, I think our mayor, I have to say, our mayor and our city council are very concerned. They're trying to review things. They're trying to defend themselves against the lawsuits from the past. They're kind of stuck in going this direction now. The alternative years ago, and no one has refuted this yet, and I keep saying it because I heard it from professional mechanical engineers, okay, is that they could have given up part of the Herndon Golf Course, maybe four holes, and built an evaporation basin out there. And it would have saved us, I mean, the total cost of that would still have been about $200 million, but it would have saved us $100.5 million at least. And now it looks like it would have saved us 200 or 300 million because of all the other problems. An evaporation basin, it wouldn't smell, it wouldn't stink, but you lose four at least of the 18 holes.
And it would be done.
And it would be done.
Right.
And it would have been done years ago.
Yep.
Okay. Nobody would have died probably. Or you never can tell. Somebody's going to stub their toe or something. But,
right.
We're not casting any aspersions here, although everybody knew, and I said for years, because I heard the rumor unofficial too, Mayor Guido said, as soon as this project starts being built, people are not going to elect me anymore. They're not going to elect me. Now, they did, as it turns out. For the last couple of years, the project was being built, and it had some disasters, and nobody brought up the tunnel as if it was a fait accompli. I mean, well, we're stuck with it now. Nothing the mayor can do. It wasn't the mayor's fault. Yes, it was. It was the fault of the mayor and the city council. But we're in this now, and the cost is monstrous, and now there's these lawsuits on top of it. And that's what the story's about. So you should read that for yourself. We do recommend you always subscribe, read the Dearborn Press and Guide and the Times Herald. They're not the same paper, you know. Every week, you can't possibly learn everything from the WHFR Journal. Because we keep expressing our own opinions so much. Jeez, just get down to the facts. So I think the rest of the facts are just mind-boggling about the cost and the projects. But I do say, if you read the quotes from Dearborn Mayor Jack O'Reilly, and let's see, is Stefalski mentioning anything in this story? I don't think so.
Regarding the CSO?
Right, the CSO. Yes, he's quoted also
right
there.
On the front page.
Right. Mm-hmm. He said, Tefelsky says, these are extremely complicated lawsuits, which is why we cannot sum them up easily for you. We don't even understand them. But but hundreds of millions of dollars are at stake. Hundreds of millions. For the lawsuits alone? I don't know. But, of course, the total cost of the project is hundreds of millions of dollars if it ever gets finished.
Did you read the very end where they talked about they're evaluating to determine whether the shafts were built too big, that they maybe went overboard and they
There might be different criteria now. Actually, they're also suggesting is those nearly dozen capture shafts is what they're called, capture shafts. But they're these huge holes in the ground, 140 feet deep at least, and. They're also suggesting that they could another approach might be to separate the sewer systems in Dearborn so that the sort of an overflow would never get into the drinking water system. Now that seems monstrous, but they've already done a little bit of that. They had a successful project in West Dearborn, which caused all that noise around Monroe Street and Brady for months. But that apparently is an alternate. But I don't think it's an alternate for the whole system. So they're going to try to do a little bit of that. But, gee, that's a perfect issue. That the overflow, that the sewage, the nasty sewage, stays by itself. And the clean water is separate. Yeah.
Sounds too easy, doesn't it?
Well, I think they might have considered it years ago. It'd be far too expensive for the whole city of Dearborn. But now they've got a lot of these so-called capture shafts that are doing nothing because they don't work. They can't even be finished. But maybe they don't need so many.
Right.
You know, so that's maybe that'll keep the cost down. And the city has had to apply for extensions to complete this with the federal government year after year after year after year. And it looks like it's going to go on more. And the extra cost in your water bills, folks, if you haven't noticed, it's not the cost of water, it's the cost of the CSO. And there's some way you can deduct this, though, on your income tax. How is that? I forget now. But it is the people of Dearborn, in our wisdom, we did vote to allow this to be paid in a way that...
Was it a separate assessment?
A separate assessment that it can be deducted on your Michigan state income tax. Maybe that depends on your income, too. Okay, well, we're going to feature a Jim Hightower comment right now on the new WHFR Journal, local news and alternative views, and we'll be back with more information. Let's see here. Okay. Let's start with this one. He has two comments here. We're going to do two comments back-to-back here on the show today. He's the progressive commentator out of Texas, who is nationally known, and for example, Ralph Nader, if you know Ralph, consumer advocate and so on, he didn't know if he was going to run in the last election for president, even though he did, and so people said, well, if you don't run, Ralph, who should run, and who would be similar to you and know what they're talking about, and he said, Jim Hightower. So, and I've read his newsletter and go to his website, jimhightower.com, a lot. And just think about what he's saying here, and we'll make some comments when we get back. The first one is one of these outrageous things about how to shake the hardship blues. If you're rich, that is. Take a listen. Jim Hightower, the new WHFR Journal, WHFR.FM, making waves.
Has today's jobless recovery got you down in the dumps? Well, perk up, Buster. What you need is a little treat. And I know just where you can find that perfect something to make you forget your troubles. The Neiman Marcus 2009 Christmas Book. For example, what's better than a good meal and good conversation with friends to warm the cockles of your heart? Well, Neiman's has it all arranged for you and a guest of your choice at the famed Algonquin Hotel in New York City. Not only will you be served gourmet delights, but you'll be seated at the historic Algonquin Round Table with eight erudite and witty sparklies, including Nora Ephron, Henry Louis Gates Jr., and George Stephanopoulos. How wonderful is that? And the entire evening is yours for only $200,000. Thanks, Neiman Marcus. If that seems a bit pricey for a one-night experience, flip the catalog's pages to the Jaguar XJL Supercharged Neiman Marcus. Yes, the luxury car maker has created a special vehicle exclusively for you catalog shoppers. Only 50 will be made, so you'd better call now. The price, if you must ask, is $105,000, but this includes a five-piece set of matching Jaguar luggage. Isn't that fun? But maybe you're one of those green shoppers. If so, here's an item that'll take your breath away. A five-foot-long chandelier made of, get this, the bottoms of plastic soda bottles. A British artist scrounged 366 bottles from a landfill to make this masterpiece, which can be yours for $12,000. And think of the righteous glow you'll get every time you flip the switch, knowing that you rescued 366 bottles from a landfill. Priceless. This is Jim Hightower saying, thumb through Neiman's catalog and you'll realize that hard times are nothing but a state of mind. I feel better just talking about it.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publishers of Hightower's new book titled Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
Funny man Bob Newhart used to do a comedy bit in which he portrayed a commanding officer addressing his troops on the eve of a big battle. The commander spoke bluntly about the bloody horror the troops would face and the certainty that many of them would not survive. The officer rallied them with appeals to courage and sacrifice, then concluded by saying, "My only regret is that I personally will not be able to go with you." That's a perfect expression of today's corporate ethic as practiced by chief executive officers. With bloody ruthlessness, CEOs constantly sacrifice workers in the name of global competitiveness, but the chiefs never seem to join in the sacrifice. We've recently been given another example of this disparity in a report on corporate pensions by the Government Accountability Office. The GAO found that four of the largest corporate bankruptcies of the last 10 years were disastrous for the employees' pension funds. Prior to their bankruptcies, United Airlines, U.S. Airways, Polaroid, and Reliance Insurance had underfunded their employees' retirement plans by $11 billion, money essentially stolen from the workers. The corporations then abandoned any responsibility for the pensions, turning the obligation over to the federal government under a program that pays only a fraction of what is owed to the employees. But guess which employees did not suffer any cut at all in their retirement money? Right, the four CEOs. Indeed, as they were underfunding and axing the workers' pension plans, the four chieftains quietly pocketed a total of nearly $50 million in retirement pay for themselves. This is Jim Hightower saying, Bob Newhart's joke has become a nightmare for millions of workers in our country. It's time for Congress to tie CEO pensions to the value of their employees' retirement funds.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book titled, Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
And we're back with more of the new WHFR Journal here at WHFR.fm, the station making waves. I think we all agree with those two situations in general. The rich get richer, and the poor seem to not get the spoils. And where's that trickle-down stuff, huh? If your boss is getting all these benefits and bonuses, where's yours?
It didn't happen in the 80s, and it's not happening now.
Nope. Those are the kinds of companies you don't want to go to work for, first of all, folks, and those are the kind of companies you don't want to support with your business either. The power of the dollar, very significant in America. You know, we're a materialistic, capitalistic country, and that's not all negative. That's what we're. That's where what we are. And therefore, the choices you make every day about the stuff you spend money on and the people you give money to, that can really change things in the long run. But everybody has to be aware of that sort of stuff. But, you know, how you participate in our capitalistic society makes can make a tremendous difference.
You know, we were talking before Thanksgiving about buying locally and the Black Friday and either don't shop or, you know, shop locally. And the Free Press actually ran a nice piece that addressed buying in Michigan. You know, a lot of these Michigan-made products, and if you can't buy local, it really, I try and focus on buying Michigan-made products.
Yep. Yep, I wish there was a website. I know there's actually a couple of franchise stores that are called Made in Michigan or something like that.
That's right.
In some shopping centers, not in Fairlane Town Center, but
there used to be one in Fairlane.
Right. Well, they used to have almost everything in Fairlane Town Center.
Yeah.
Sorry to say. Oh well. We want to look at just a few more stories here for you. One that I wanted to bring up is an editorial opinion that's in the Press and Guide from last Sunday, December 6th. The editorial writer is Tom Watkins, who is a former head of the Michigan Department of Education until he was legislated out, kicked out by Governor Granholm for being a do-nothing head of the Michigan Department of Education. And so he's going to attack Granholm here, but we know that he has a personal axe to grind. He does have a lot of good ideas. He has traveled to China as a business consultant. He found money to make that happen. And he has a lot of opinions, especially about education. And so let's listen to this one. Most of us here, Amy, Dennis, and I, we think that the only way out of the crisis facing Michigan is... We think services have been cut, especially education, just about as far as it'll go, is higher taxes. But we think, I'm speaking for them, but it's got to be a graduated tax increase. It's got to be progressive, as they call it, because the poor people can't afford to pay anymore. But the rich people seem to be doing okay. At least they've got their jobs. And somebody has to get the state turned around and maintain the services for all of us. There may be another answer other than taxes. Legislature could come up with a couple of radical proposals of different kinds of taxes, like the fare tax, which is a consumption tax with a difference. And we've had speakers on here, and we will in the future. Yours truly is very much in favor of fare tax, whether it's Michigan only or fare tax for the whole country. It would eliminate withholding from your paychecks, if you have a paycheck. And in some cases, 30% of the money that you earn, you don't see it each week. Sort of a hidden tax, because a lot of people don't even realize they make so much money because they don't get to keep it. 30% is taken away to go to the government, and then maybe you'll get some back at income tax time, or maybe you'll still owe more. Okay, the fair tax does away with withholding, does away with the IRS, so you don't have to pay any taxes to the federal government April 15th each year. But everything you buy goes up in price, and they add a hefty consumption tax, think of sales tax, about 30%, okay? And they have this in Canada, they have a lot of other civilized countries, but they don't have the final twist and turn, which makes the fair tax proposal so good. And although I am not currently a supporter of Mike Huckabee for president, he was the only Republican or Democrat that was in favor of the capital F, capital T fair tax proposal that I'm describing here. And he's still for it on his TV show. He still talks about it. He's on Fox, of course. And by golly, here's the thing. No more withholding. no taxes to pay at all. Not for business, not for individuals, but anything you buy, they estimate you'll have to pay about 30% more in this fair tax. 30% more. I said, well, the poor can't afford 30% more. Yeah, the rich could, especially if you're not paying that withholding tax of a third to the government in your paycheck. You've got a third of your paycheck still there, and you're not going to buy as much as your paycheck every week, are you? Well, in any event, checks come back from the government, whether it's a state fair tax or whether it's a national fair tax. Everybody, rich and poor, will get the same amount of reimbursement check every month. Okay, and that's figured out so that it basically reimburses the family of four at the poverty level for the extra 30% they pay on housing, food, shelter. Okay, so they're actually getting paychecks from the government every month that will reimburse them for that extra 30% because they're still at the lowest level and they can't afford it. So that's how it happens. But to make it easy to implement, you know, across the whole United States, they have to make it a set fee, and they estimate 28% to 30% additional cost. It'll go directly from the vendor to the federal government, or in this case, it'll go to the state government. And I just had the New York Times, just say briefly, New York Times had a short opinion piece on how people, even in Washington, D.C., are thinking, how are we going to pay for that Afghanistan affair and other costs here, the job stimulus packages that might still be needed? Oh, and as Gentner said, the further bailouts of the banks, which he now wants to continue until next fall, 2010. That went over like a lead balloon in Congress. But how are you going to pay for that? Whether or not you like any of those things, how you want to pay for it? And they're suggesting a consumption tax. But no rebate for the poor. That's the bad news there. That's okay. So Tom Watkins, though, says, Michigan's government is sick. And new taxes, that's what he's against here, without significant reforms are not the medicine to fix it. Governor Jennifer Granholm, he says, is clearly attempting to mobilize residents to force another tax increase. She's using one of the oldest plays in the tax hiker's playbook. Make sure you cut the government services that will inflict the most pain on the voters, the ones that will get people energized and generate heat on those anti-tax legislative holdouts. Hence the layoffs of Michigan State Police troopers, cuts to schools in general, and an extra cut to predominantly Republican anti-tax districts. That's talking about Dearborn, by the way, folks. I don't know if we're really predominantly Republican, but, you know, the anti-tax people who tried to get Andy Dillon recalled are from this area, Dearborn Heights. I mean, that's where the organization leaders are kind of living. Okay. So the state, he says, is an economic freefall. So does Jack Lessenberry say the same thing. Next year is going to be worse than this year, says Lessenberry in the Metro Times. In the end, it will require, says Watkins, in this order, cuts, reforms, and a new tax structure to fix it. Ah, what about the fair tax, Tom? Oh, well. He says, we have cut and raised taxes, but have not added the most important ingredient, reform. Beyond reform, there's another major flaw in the tactics and strategy of our state leaders. It's a belief in government's legitimacy that allows the tax system to work. Today, Michigan's political leadership lacks the credibility that allows government to function effectively, let alone the legitimacy to extract more taxes to protect a dysfunctional status quo. Now, what he doesn't talk about here, other than trust, yeah, we have to trust our government or, you know, we won't do it, is what reforms is he talking about? And I'm sorry, Tom, I don't see any reforms here. You said new taxes without reforms are not the medicine Michigan needs. What's the reform? I believe the tax structure should be reformed. We just talked about the fair tax. That would be a reform. He does say, and we've pointed out here too, by golly, November 2010 ballot, okay, less than a year away now, 11 months, folks, under our state constitution, once every 16 years only, the voters are asked, do you want to revise the state constitution? There's no doubt about it, we do, folks. Oh, who knows what changes might come about? It could be terrible. Well, it won't be any worse than the situation we're in now. I don't think so, because we're going down, and I'm not fear-mongering like Glenn Beck here, but I'm using a lot of conservative, even Republican, spokespeople like Tom Watkins to, I wonder if he really is a Republican, anyway, to make these statements. Obviously, all the Republicans in the Michigan State Senate are not for tax increases. at all. But where are these reforms, like reforms to the tax system? Not one proposed. We're still waiting on a return call or email from Senator Bishop, the Republican majority leader in the Michigan Lansing.
Yeah, dropped off Senate. The face of the earth.
Well, we know it's holiday season. They have to go out and party.
Yeah.
They can't be concerned about the state going down the tubes or up the creek or whatever. They have to go out and party with their constituents. In a crisis time like this, to heck with vacations. You know, keep doing your job until you get some answers. I'm sorry. That's a Scrooge in me, I guess. Bah humbug.
No, it sounds actually practical.
If you haven't done anything significant to reform or to change the direction of the state, not just cuts, as I agree with Tom, not just cuts, but then it's not going to get better. It's not going to get better. Stimulus money, jobs, it's going to take years before that's all sort of kicks in and levels out. That's if the state of Michigan can regroup and go a direction towards both clean energy and clean energy jobs. That's the only way to go, and we've got a long way to go before that's going to be self-sustaining here. So agree with Tom, but I also don't see exactly what reforms he's for. I totally agree that we've got to do something on the 2010 ballot. When we talked to Andy Dillon on the phone a couple weeks ago, he called us back and we talked to him. He says he wants budget change and reform to be worked out by next March. Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, sure.
And we have a new date on the, was it June 1st or July 1st rather than
yes.
October date?
Yes, at least that the New Year's budget starts July 1st. Duh, you have to have everything in place before then, or the school districts, businesses, everybody doesn't know what's happening. You get through a third to half of the year and you got to make all these cuts. It's disaster. You have no time to plan. You made promises, which you have to go back on to your workers, to your communities. At least that. But will the legislatures pigeonhole themselves? No, they won't. Besides Bishop, Dillon, others, they're term limited. They're out of here even before next July 1st. So do they really care? No, they don't really care. I mean, don't care about what comes after.
They care to the extent of the next job they're seeking and how they'll position themselves for
of
that
course.
Next job.
Right. And some of them, Dillon may go on to be a state senator or, they sort of stay in government, but they take a different house. So there are things to do. And although I say if they're lame ducks, why not do significant reform? Get the act together. Drop the partisanship. And if you got nothing to lose, except maybe your next job, unfortunately, do something really good.
And if you accomplish something, then your next job will be that much better.
Yeah, if it really works, boy, you'll be famous.
Yeah, exactly. And that's funny because, and I think Lessenberry is a big guy, talks about the legacy a lot and how Granholm has an opportunity here to really change everything she's done. And that's the hope.
No, it seems like she's really going out with a whimper rather than a bang.
A resounding thud.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see. They still got 6 months left of active, really active time before they have to go crazy there. What else would we like to talk about, folks? I've got to bring up, if I can dig it up here, where's the, Representative John Conyers. Got a phone call from President Obama. Now, he represents the eastern side of Dearborn. And this was available online. Molly Hooper in a publication online called The Hill and also at commondreams.org. He got called by President Obama, Representative John Conyers. And this is what it's all about. This is amazing. And I don't think it was reported in any other paper, even though he's our local rep, so I thought I'd bring this up. President Barack Obama recently called Representative John Conyers Jr. to express his frustrations with the Judiciary Committee chairman's criticism. In an interview with The Hill, which is this publication, which I'm not familiar with, but anyway, Conyers said his opinions of Obama's policies on health care reform and the war in Afghanistan have not sat well with the president. According to the lawmaker, the president picked up the phone several weeks ago, and this is current story as of Tuesday, December the 8th, so just a couple weeks back around Thanksgiving. Happy Thanksgiving, John Conyers. I hate what you're saying about me. Anyway, I don't know what the words were, but here we'll hear the story. So he said he picked up the phone several weeks to find out why Conyers was, quote, demeaning him, unquote. Apparently the president used those words. Why are you demeaning me?
Doesn't it sound very awkward? Why are you demeaning me?
The literal meaning is taking away meaning.
Right.
Sure.
Taking away significance.
Harsh, childish.
Harsh
but
criticism,
it is,
maybe.
It's got a nasty connotation to demean someone. It's like bullying almost in school or something. But anyway, Obama's decision to challenge Conyers highlights a sensitivity to criticism the president has taken on the left. Conyers' critical remarks, of course, he's been criticized on the right all the time, but and I think he over-responds to that because supposedly that, you know, Republicans are not that many in Congress, but there's all the Fox pundits who...
Right, and too much time...
Exaggerate it.
Responding to Limbaugh.
Yeah, yeah, other than all the others. Anyway, Conyers' critical remarks, many of which have been reported on the liberal-leaning Huffington Post... And that's not a newspaper, that is a website, but Adriana Huffington is behind that. And it's becoming quite an important news source on the internet, by the way. Huffington Post, that's two Fs, huffingtonpost.com. These liberal comments against policies of Obama that appeared in the Huffington Post appear to have irritated the president, known for his calm demeanor. Conyers, the second longest-serving member of the House, said, quote, Obama called me and told me that he heard that I was demeaning him. Oh, he heard I was demeaning. And I had to explain to him that it wasn't anything personal. It was an honest difference on the issues. And he said, quote, well, let's talk about it, unquote. Sitting in the Judiciary Committee's conference room 2 days after Obama delivered a speech on Afghanistan, the 23-term lawmaker, John Conyers Jr., said he wasn't in the mood to chat. That's what he told the president. I'm not in the mood to chat.
Well, that's what I would say, too.
Yeah, on the phone. What can you do? What can we do in an hour in the journal? I mean, even if President Obama was here, what can we do, really, to get to the core of... thank you, Amy. But what can we do to resolve questions? Well, most of these issues are very complicated,
absolutely.
And to give equal time to all opinions and to work out answers and an action plan, it's not going to happen in a telephone chat. Anyway, Obama's move to send in 30,000 troops to Afghanistan by the summer of 2010 has clearly disappointed Conyers. Conyers said he intends to press his case in writing soon. Quote, I want something so serious that he has to respond in writing like I am responding in writing to him. That's according to Conyers. Calling in generals and admirals to discuss troop strength is like me taking my youngest to McDonald's to ask if he likes French fries, said Conyers. Many on the left have argued that military leaders routinely respond to crises by calling for more troops. From Conyers, I've been saying I don't agree with him on Afghanistan. I think he screwed up on health care reform, on Guantanamo, and kicking Gregg off. And that's, finally, Conyers is referring there to the departure of former White House counsel Gregg Craig. I hadn't heard of his name before, Gregg Craig.
I hadn't heard of him either. But you know what I think instantly? These aren't new things that Obama's bringing up. He mentioned these during the campaign, that he felt we should be bringing, you know, putting more troops into Afghanistan. He supported Bush in the government bailout of the banks. It's so unfortunate that these voices weren't a little louder during the campaign.
Yeah, they believe that Craig, by the way, was kicked out because he was the one that was trying to bring about almost immediate closing of Guantanamo Bay Detention Center, which is not closing now. But that was a very clear-cut campaign promise.
Right.
We're going to get out of Iraq, get out of Abu Ghraib, and also close Guantanamo Prison.
But
it's not going to happen
specifics,
now.
Specifics, yeah.
I don't know when it's going to happen, if it ever does. What do you do with the prisoners? Well, most of them have never been tried, so why don't you just let them go? I'm sorry. You don't have a case against them. You got some people that think they're bad people. And after being held there for a couple of years, I bet they're quite bad now.
Sure.
Jeez, I'd be mad, especially if I was innocent. Well, anyway, so Amy, were you going to have another comment there?
No, a military trial. I don't think they should be brought back to the States. One, they should have had representation ages ago, but it's a long, you know. We don't want to go there. It's an old story, but it's unfortunate that they didn't get due process or at least a military trial and address it.
Since it was in the comment, so again, just finishing up that story about Representative Conyers, he's going to keep saying what he's saying. He always has. And he's going to write a formal letter and hope Obama will respond. But he's definitely against the buildup in Afghanistan. Opinions are varied from the progressives, that is, the anti-war people on the left. I've heard some on NPR this morning, and I've read some comments about Afghanistan war buildup. A lot of the anti-war people say, oh, yeah, we agree with Obama, like it in his Nobel Prize, Peace Prize acceptance speech. Afghanistan is a just war. Now, all the others, we shouldn't be doing. But Afghanistan is a just war. However, they say, I'm anti-war. I'm a pacifist. But I think Afghanistan is fine. Now, I don't see how you can be anti-war and a pacifist and be for any war at any time. Remember, there's only 100 al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. What the heck are we doing there? We already missed out. Bin Laden's not there. We missed out on him years ago. If he was behind the attack on the Twin Towers and the Pentagon and Flight United 93 and so on, and that hasn't been proven to me yet, but if he was behind that, let's find him and arrest him. But 100 people, more innocent people have died in Iraq, and they estimate now close to 200,000, than any sort of military combatants that we've had to shoot because they were shooting at us. 200,000 innocent lives. And the same thing in Afghanistan. More innocent people are dying all the time, not people who are guilty of anything or even shooting at us. And Afghanistan is almost like a no-win situation with all those caves and all those mountains. And like, even the neocons don't want to go into Afghanistan except in their wildest fantasies of letting other people kill for them, which has got to be exciting, right? Because there's no oil, unless they want a percent of the poppy sales, for themselves.
Well, the poppy fields. Taliban comes in, they take care of the poppy fields.
Well, that's true. When the Taliban was in control up to 2003, they had cut down poppy, that is opium production, mm-hmm. to almost nothing, because
right.
they felt it was illegal, immoral, to do that to anybody, to have those kinds of narcotics and to make money off of them. And they were the most effective agent for cutting the opium.
Right.
That's the number one country in the world supplying opium to everybody else, including our heroin addicts, too, over here. Now just it's skyrocketed in production. It's doing just fine, which means our soldiers aren't doing anything to keep the poppies from
Well, I don't know if that's
grown.
Necessarily their role either, a defined
no,
role.
No, but if it's you're going to rebuild a country, okay,
right.
Country building.
I'm rolling my eyes.
Nation
yeah.
building. Then it's not a matter of killing people. It's a matter of people getting water and food and jobs and education. And we could do that a lot cheaper than what we're doing.
But that's their number one export, isn't it?
I only recommend, even though it's a local show and our podcast is going to be cutting off and Highway 61 is starting up in just a few seconds, Norman Solomon. Got that name? Norman Solomon. He has an editorial on commondreams.org, and it's entitled, Mr. President, War is Not Peace. I can't share that with you. Besides, is it local?